Any number of operatic characters are obsessed. Often that obsession centers on unrequited love, or even more frequently, a desperate desire for revenge. Think of Count di Luna in Il Trovatore, or the title role of Elektra. But there's no one in opera more obsessed than German, the hapless protagonist of Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky's Pikhovaya Dama, the Queen of Spades. It's German's desire to win at cards that leads to catastrophe, not just for him, but for the woman he loves. Hello, I'm Roger Pines, dramaturg at Lyric Opera of Chicago, and I'm delighted to give you some comments regarding a work that will be making its long-awaited return to Lyric during the 2019-2020 season, the company's first Queen of Spades in two decades. Let's begin with a very quick rundown of the story. In late 18th century St. Petersburg, German, an army officer, hears from his friend Count Tomsky that the mysterious countess possesses the secret of winning at cards. German falls in love with the countess's granddaughter, Liza, and she with him, although she's betrothed to Prince Yeletsky. German's wish to learn the secret gradually overwhelms his love for Liza. When he confronts the countess and begs her for the secret, she dies of fright before she can reveal it. She later appears to German in a dream and reveals the three winning cards, the 3, 7, and 8, played in succession. German's obliviousness to everything but the secret terrifies Liza, whose misery leads her to suicide. When German plays against Yeletsky at the gambling table, the final card reveals not the winning ace, but the Queen of Spades. German shoots himself in despair. German was totally a natural for opera and for Tchaikovsky. The character himself was created by that giant of Russian fiction, Alexander Pushkin. German is one of opera's true outsiders. In Pushkin's story, he's uninterested in anything except pursuing the secret of winning at cards and has little to communicate to those around him. Tchaikovsky was a deeply vulnerable, neurotic man, compelled to repress his true sexuality. He then was a loner as well, sublimating his feelings into music of consuming passion. Pushkin's work had attracted Tchaikovsky before, first in the most popular of all Russian operas, Eugene Onegin, in 1879, and a few years later, the much less familiar drama of love and revenge, Mazeppa. The sheer directness of Pushkin's language made a direct appeal to Tchaikovsky's sensibilities and spurred him on to his greatest heights of operatic achievement. Before going any further, let's clear up one mystery. The opera is more often than not referred to internationally as Pique Dame. What's that about? After all, it's not a French work, even if Tchaikovsky did drop a French aria into the score. More on that in a few minutes. Surprisingly enough, it was performances in the German-speaking world that popularized the Pique Dame title, whereas if one were actually going to refer to it in correct French, that title really should be Dame de Pique. Pikhovaya Dama was Tchaikovsky's next-to-last opera. He would end his operatic career with a one-act, Yolanta, 2 years later. The Western Hemisphere tends to forget that Tchaikovsky actually produced 11 operas. Although his operatic output covered 23 years, half of these works were composed during the last decade of his life, when his technical brilliance and interpretive imagination were at their peak. Even if Tchaikovsky had only written The Queen of Spades and Eugene Onegin, he would have achieved enduring stature as an operatic composer. The Queen of Spades is unusual for Tchaikovsky in that the majority of his protagonists are women. He was no doubt longing to create a stupendously exciting central role for a man, one that would test all of the singer's musical and dramatic resources to the full. Tchaikovsky's close relationship with his brother Modeste included two operatic collaborations for which Modeste provided the texts. First, The Queen of Spades, and 2 years later, Yolanta. By the way, because we have two Tchaikovskys here, in what follows, I'll refer to them by their first names. How fortunate that at this point in Peter Ilyich's life, when he was comparatively fragile and vulnerable, he had the support of an artistic partner who understood him so thoroughly. The fact that Modeste, like his brother, was himself homosexual surely created an even closer bond between the two and helped them to be completely open in their emotional communication with each other. That the Queen of Spades ever saw the light of day is due in large part to Modeste's powers of persuasion. It happened that he was going to adapt Pushkin's short story of the same name into a libretto for another composer, Nikolai Klinovsky, a conductor at the Bolshoi Theater in Moscow. Klinovsky had a commission from the Bolshoi, with this story as the subject. Peter Ilyich was interested in it, but he graciously waited for Klinovsky's right of refusal. Klinovsky had a librettist, but dragged his heels and finally simply lost interest in the project. Modeste brought the possibility of an operatic Queen of Spades to his brother's attention, and the wheels began to turn in Peter Ilyich's mind. He was actually returning to this idea. Setting Pushkin's story for the operatic stage had already occurred to him years before. The Queen of Spades became Peter Ilyich's own personal obsession. After settling himself in Florence during early 1890, he created the music during 44 days of non-stop work. He was ecstatic with the finished product and remained totally convinced that he'd created a masterpiece. By mid-June, having returned to Russia, he was able to complete the orchestration. The premiere occurred on December 19, 1890, at the Mariinsky Theater in St. Petersburg. It was not exactly ideal holiday fare, but still, Tchaikovsky scored a huge public success. One wonders if the opera would have enjoyed the triumph it did without the involvement of three of the greatest artists of the day. On the podium, first of all, Peter Ilyich had one of the 19th century's most eminent conductors, Eduard Napravnik, a Czech musician who'd become principal conductor of the Mariinsky. On stage was a married couple, the Russian heroic tenor Nikolai Figner and the Italian soprano Medea May Figner. Who can even imagine how their offstage relationship was affected by playing German and Lisa? We're privileged to be able to hear on records those two singers in music from the Queen of Spades. Listening to them in their characters' arias, we hear the most extraordinary elegance and control, each phrase sculpted with the greatest care. Those recordings provide confirmation, as if we needed it, that Tchaikovsky wrote to flatter singers. He completely understood the voice, and he worshipped his Italian predecessors in opera. That was more than just lip service. Verdi himself would have been proud to have written such music. The Queen of Spades has, as its dramatic source, the best-known short story in all of Russian literature. It's no surprise that two other skilled operatic composers, Frommenthal Alevi and Franz von Suppé, had already gotten their hands on it before Peter Ilyich. How could they resist these characters? The crazed German, the unhappy Lisa, and the imperious Countess are simply crying out for operatic treatment. As with Giovanni Paisiello's Barber of Seville versus Gioacchino Rossini's, Peter Ilyich's version of this story is the one that has lasted the course. Within two decades after its premiere, it had acquired an international audience, including in New York, where the Metropolitan Opera gave the American premiere in 1910. Had Peter Ilyich and his brother followed Pushkin to the letter, most probably the Queen of Spades would never have succeeded. Operatic audiences being what they are, a love story was essential, which leads us to the most crucial difference between the short story and the opera. The relationship between Pushkin's German and Lisa is related entirely to his desire to get access to the Countess, which Lisa makes possible. In the opera, on the other hand, we need only listen to German's plea to Lisa toward the end of Act I to understand that the man is obsessed not just by cards, but by Lisa as well. The tragedy, of course, is that the cards win out in the end. The Tchaikovsky operas represented, in effect, the last gasp of the Romantic period in Russian opera. The audiences simply required a romantic element in any work, particularly for Tchaikovsky after his triumph with Onegin. There are quite a few other intriguing departures from Pushkin. In the story, the Countess is the orphaned Liza's guardian, and the girl herself is treated basically as little more than a paid companion. In Tchaikovsky, Liza is the Countess's granddaughter. In Pushkin, Liza survives to marry a man Pushkin calls a very pleasant civil servant. In Tchaikovsky, she's totally in despair in her final confrontation with Garamond, and she kills herself when she realizes that his gambling obsession has consumed him. The opera does include a role for Liza's fiancé, the noble Prince Yeletsky, who doesn't appear in the story at all. Pushkin's story is incredibly concise, with not one wasted word. The opera, too, is quite tightly structured, but Peter Ilyich and Modeste make room for local color in a major way. The opera's opening scene in the public summer garden in St. Petersburg, the nannies, nurserymaids, and governesses, along with a chorus of boy soldiers, give a delightful view into domestic life in late 18th century St. Petersburg. It also adds to the necessity of creating a certain variety in the score. One would tire of Garamond's unrelenting intensity if it weren't contrasted with some lighter moments. The same thing is true with the guests at the ball in Act II and the male chorus of gamblers in the final scene. For pure diversion, the Tchaikovskys created an intermezzo in the ball scene, a tribute to composers of the Baroque and early classical era, where, in between important scenes for the principals, the audience was given a breather with a light, often comic, usually romantic number. In The Queen of Spades, it's an endearing duet between the mythological lovers Daphnis and Chloe, followed by a trio in which those two are joined by the god Pluto. This is for contralto, soprano, and baritone. It's generally sung by the same singers who in the opera proper are Pauline, Liza, and Tomsky. I want to mention two supporting characters that we don't encounter in Pushkin. In the opera, each is given a glorious solo opportunity. First, in the opera's second scene, when Liza sings for her friends, one of them, Pauline, joins her for a duet. But Pauline then sits at the piano and accompanies herself in a romance, that is, a typically melancholy, sentimental Russian song. The text is all about how the character singing the song once lived happily playing in the fields of Arcady and felt the promise of love, but all life had to offer was the grave. Pauline is that rare role written for a young contralto. And there's another feature very unusual for 19th century opera in general. In this number, the only accompaniment for the voice is actually solo piano. Although Pauline says this is her favorite song, clearly it's not what she's about as a character. She then proceeds to lead the group in a rollicking song that shakes off the melancholy mood. We don't get much character beyond sheer sincerity from the elegant Prince Yeletsky, the other important character not found in Pushkin, but he does have an extraordinarily touching moment in the Act II ball scene. He and Liza are there together, and she's avoiding him. He begs her to confide in him. The whole aria makes clear that he's ready to give his life to make her happy. It's a classic Tchaikovsky legato number with a glorious ascent to a high G near the end and a beautiful, floated, closing phrase. If the Liza and Garamond aren't stellar, a good Yeletsky can walk off with the show. We get comparatively little singing from the Countess, but what there is makes a significant impact. It's vital, of course, that the mezzo-soprano or contralto who sings the role give a regality to the character, but the most important quality is world-weariness. This is a woman who has seen it all, and she's also certainly living in her glorious past as the belle of French aristocratic society. That accounts for her retreat into memories in her bedroom scene in Act II. That retreat comes courtesy not of Peter Ilyich, but of the composer from whom he borrowed. a pillar of late 18th century French opera, André Grétry. His opera, Richard Cœur de Lion, Richard the Lionhearted, includes a lovely number for light soprano. Peter Ilyich transposed it down several tones and used the A section only with the original French text. The result was a moment of exquisite nostalgia as the Countess remembers singing in the presence of the King of France. The first Lisa, Medea May Figner, was a particularly rich voice singer who'd started as a mezzo-soprano before taking on spinto-soprano roles. As a result, Peter Ilyich composed music for her that requires really exceptional warmth through the whole range, all the way up to high B. The role includes two intensely expressive arias, and both of them build to stupendous climaxes. If we don't feel we know her quite as well as we know Tatiana in Eugene Onegin, that's perhaps because the opera is so thoroughly dominated by the figure of German. Nikolai Figner was just as remarkable a singer as his wife. With him, there were basically no vocal limits, so Peter Ilyich apparently had no qualms in composing music that asked for massive power in every scene. Of all tenor roles in Russian opera, this is the one that truly separates the men from the boys. Whether in recitative, three arias, or the climactic duet in which Lisa realizes that he's lost to her, this role poses huge challenges to a dramatic tenor's vocal and dramatic resources. In terms of actually portraying German, the task is to create a sympathetic personality, which Pushkin doesn't do at all. No doubt the story was meant to create a fascinating exploration of the psychology of an obsessed gambler. But in the end, the reader doesn't particularly care about the outcome. German, by the way, doesn't die in the story. Instead, he simply goes mad and is confined to a hospital, answering no question put to him and simply muttering continually, 3-7-ace, 3-7-queen. In contrast, in the opera, as German dies, his final words are that he loves Lisa, his angel, his goddess, whom he hopes will forgive him. With the male chorus quietly praying for his troubled spirit to find peace, Tchaikovsky creates a profoundly moving conclusion to an opera that no audience will ever forget. Lyrics commentaries are made possible through the generous support of the Patrick G. and Shirley Welsh Ryan Foundation in memory of their parents. Thank you for listening.